President Trump has just wrapped up his first meeting in a long time with President Xi Jinping. And this was a very testy time going in because there was a lot of things on the table, a lot of issues with trade, with tariffs, especially this trade war that's been going on, a lot of tough rhetoric coming out of both sides. And now then the question is going to be, how did this come out? Well, according to President Trump, the meeting was wonderful. It was a 12 out of 10, he said, or putting it in his own words.
I thought it was an amazing meeting. He's a great leader of a very powerful, very strong country, China. And what can I say? We have, it was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made. A lot of decisions were made, too. There wasn't too much left out there. Taiwan never came up. It's not discussed, actually. We had a long meeting, as you know, but a lot of things we discussed in great detail. A lot of things we brought to finalization. A lot of finalization. I thought it was a great meeting. I think it was a very friendly meeting. It was a good meeting for two very large, powerful countries. And that's the way we should get along with a large, powerful.
Why did you write your trip?
Well, there you have it. It was a great meeting, but interesting things. Lots of stuff was discussed, lots of meetings that were had, but interesting things that were not on the agenda, apparently, for all the things that were in this 12 out of 10, as he put it. Curious that the Taiwan issue wasn't on there, for example. And by the way, I know a lot of you are expecting Alistair Crook. He will be with us shortly. We had some connection issues, but fear not, he is coming soon. But let's take a look at that issue here, because no Taiwan, that's kind of important. When you're talking about the potential for military clash between the United States and China, and a lot of our military is focused in that direction, a lot of, you know, these freedom of navigation operations, which has always been a contentious issue, China's surrounding Taiwan with these frequent military maneuvers, the potential blockades that they practice, air flyovers into the Taiwanese airspace, et cetera. All those kinds of things weren't on the table. It might have been a really good opportunity to discuss some of those thornier issues. You may recall that during the Biden administration, there were three separate times when he said, we would defend Taiwan. If it comes to fighting a war with China, we would defend Taiwan. All three were later walked back by the administration, but the president himself said, yes, we would, leaving the Chinese to wonder what was actually the Americans' plan. Now, some may say that strategic ambiguity might have been good, or these mixed messages would keep the Chinese guessing. That may well be the case. But as I always say, that's a double-edged sword when your adversaries and opponents are not clear what you would do, what you wouldn't do. It makes them nervous and it could push them into taking actions that they think, all right, well, if this is really what their position is, then we better be ready to act here. And it might even cause them to take action they otherwise might not. But again, that was Joe Biden. Now the question is with Trump. He's been a lot more mum on this. Now that we do continue to provide weapons and other kinds of things onto to Taiwan that we've given them over the time, even with Trump inside here, and he has not weighed in on the issue of what he would do in the event of a conflict between China and Taiwan. But a lot of the issues on the table are there, and the risk of the conflict between the two, especially since the new Taiwanese president came on board, are a little bit more than just a normal type of difficult. And I believe that we have Alistair Crook. Well, I guess we don't have him quite yet. We have an empty chair, though. So I guess that's something. We have his chair. So hopefully soon we'll be getting him back in. Gary, if you can bring him back up as soon as that comes in. But one of the other things that was not, at least it was not been discussed in public so far, and we have to only hope that these things were discussed behind the scenes, and that is any kind of nuclear testing. Now, we'll talk later in the day about the fact that the Russians have tested a couple of nuclear-capable, one below-surface drone-type situation and another missile that has been launched. And we've talked about that. And then now then the question is going to be, where are we going to go with nuclear testing, and will it include anything with China? And now I see we have Ambassador Alistair Crook in, geopolitical commentator and author at conflictsforum.substack.com. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the show. A pleasure to have you on board.
Thank you very much indeed. Can you hear me okay?
Hear you loud and clear. Absolutely perfect.
Good
to go there. Well, listen, let's just jump right into it. First of all, welcome to the show. A lot of people have been asking for you in our audience for a long time, so we're glad we're finally to be able to make the connection.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. It's good to be with you. I watch your show often.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. We appreciate that. Well, listen, let's just jump right into this situation here, because it's kind of a big issue, or at least it could be a big issue, between any time you have two, big powers, economic and military powers in the United States and China getting together and talking. That's always a good thing. So I'm just categorically for any of that, and certainly came out looking like at least congenial on the surface of it. But it was interesting. And as I was mentioning a second ago, in Trump's characterization of this meeting, it was quite effusive, a 12 out of 10, as he put it. But we thought it was interesting that Taiwan wasn't on the menu. So first of all, kind of just like from all of your overall assessment, how would you put this meeting so far?
I would say that we know actually very little about what was the detail of what was being agreed at all. We've got, as usual, a very optimistic, it was great, amazing meeting. But the devil will be in the details of this. And the details, I don't think, will work out to be as beneficial and as amazing as is suggested. If you go through the real areas, first of all, in terms of rare earths, which was, of course, the center. There were three things: the rare earth, the soya beans, and the tariffs were the main thing, that they were the pillars, if you like. There were other things, but they were subsidiary. But on the rare earths, China does not just predominate, it actually completely controls this. And they've been preparing this for some time, for really more than a year. And the point is not just the rare earths, because this keeps getting put in this way that, you know, there are other rare earths in Malaysia, in Australia, and he's done lots of deals to get these rare earths, and so it's fine. No, it's not like that, because the main problem in this is the refining of it into the metals that are used in weapons and in many electronics. And basically, China controls 93% of the refining capacity. Mm. And it controls 70% of rare earths anyway, global use of rare earths. And it controls 100% of some critical ones too. So they're not just present, they are absolutely dominating this market. And also now they put a licensing on it as well. So you have to have a license, if other than America, but if another state wants to take rare earths, you have to have a license from China. And just as the United States does with its, if you like, military equipment, China can say, well, we're not going to license this if it is for onward transmission to the United States, or if it is intended use is military purposes. So their control is really very strong. And this is really what Trump is having to contend with. So he's got something of a, if you like, a pause, a truce on this. But it will take the United States years, if you like, first of all, to get the other rare earths from other places, and then to refine them. Because first of all, they don't have the refining capacity. They don't have the equipment, which China has a monopoly of. And they don't have, if you like, the premises. I mean, you know, it's quite costly and also quite environmentally dangerous, these refining plants. Now, China's had them for years and they got them at a low cost. But if America wanted to copy that, it will be very much more expensive than it has been for China. So there's a real advantage there. Now, on the other aspect of it, which was soybeans.
Well, and actually, I'm sorry, before you get to the soybean part, I definitely want to cover that. But I want to show a clip here of how Trump has characterized the issue with the rare earths.
So we continue to produce the rare earths and buy the rare earths and everything else, you know, when you see from other countries. But China is, that whole situation, that roadblock is gone now. There's no roadblock at all on rare earth. That will hopefully disappear from our vocabulary for a little while.
Disappear for a little while. But I mean, this whole issue of roadblock, this was part of the trade war that was going on earlier this year. There was a big issue with China saying, we're going to curtail that stuff that you need for your missile production, aircraft production, and other kinds of weapon systems. And especially on these magnets, et cetera, they were put a hold on them. I guess you have to say we have to see the devil's in the details, but do you have any sense for what Trump means when he says the roadblock has removed? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem that it would necessarily be in China's advantage to just turn the spigots fully back on and let everything go like that. How do you see that?
Well, exactly. We don't see it. And don't forget, I mean, first of all, you know, Trump portrayed this as being something out of the blue. China suddenly put these export controls on rare earths, and it was outrageous and improper that he'd done it. I mean, he went really quite hyperbolic about this, but it wasn't like that. In fact, what had happened was that during the Chinese had a long holiday at that period, a week's holiday, and during that period, after some quite positive talks, trade talks, suddenly the Commerce Department, and not through the cabinet, not agreed in cabinet, but the Commerce Department decided to extend what were tariff controls on what they call listed items on the entity list. It's called the entity list. I can't remember why exactly. But if you were on the entity list, then they extended American tech controls to the entity list. So suddenly, all of these technical things that China was buying from America were on an export control system. And so they replied by putting the rare earths onto export controls at the same time. So it was a complete quid pro quo, you know, a tit for tat, if you like, process that happened. And so surely there was an agreement then that all the export controls, including on some ships and others, were released for China as part of the quid pro quo of a truce on in respect of the a truce in respect to the rare earths, and so I think that part of it you won't hear much about, because I don't think some of the American companies will be so happy that the tech controls have been lessened on materials, on technical components going to China, because China is moving very fast in this field. In fact, I suspect that Huawei has actually overtaken America in terms of its ability to produce these chips. In fact, I saw only today that Huawei have managed, I think, to produce, to print these things, they're printed by lithograph, has managed to produce 99% purity without faults. I mean, 99
wow,
perfect chips. So they're moving very fast, and Huawei is investing huge amounts and constructing new laboratories and what have you. And so I think there will be, this is part of the details that we don't see, and others will be concerned about it. And really, this is so much at the center because strategically, the general view amongst the banks, amongst people who look at it, is that the United States AI is a bubble, and a bubble that is burst at any time, because essentially it is now so exaggerated, the valuations of the AI companies, what they call the Magnificent Seven, NVIDIA and OpenAI and all these things, constitute almost the entire valuation of the American Stock Exchange. I mean, they are at a 125-year peak, these valuations. And what is concerning people is two things. One is that it seems that it's a self-completing circle, self-referencing circle. So OpenAI gives money to NVIDIA, and NVIDIA then gives it back again in a different form. And this, you know, large hundreds of billions is sort of going around in a circular fashion, which is reminiscent of sort of other problems in the markets that we've heard before. And that the feeling is that this could burst at any time, and that China would be able to be the one that could burst that that bubble by producing, if you like, a cheaper, finer chip from Huawei, and then also putting it on open use, not making it subject to licensing fees or anything else, like they did with DeepSeek. That was an AI product that came out of China, and it pretty well put out of business a number of AI products. So this is really, you know, at the heart of this trade negotiations is this question of the future of AI, because America has bet heavily. It's pretty well bet completely on AI as its future, as its industrial future. In a sense, you know, before, you know, the petrodollar was the sort of golden goose that would provide dollars and dollars, and they all came to America and then were lent out, or as they bought US treasuries, and then these dollars were used for other purposes. So so this AI thing is very crucial, and it looks as if there's some sort of agreement that has been reached here. But the question is for how long.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. Especially if you're betting everything on this working out here, if you have a bottleneck of 93% of the refinement capacities for rare earths being in Chinese control, that seems that would put your whole model at any risk at any time if China wanted to pull the string and close that bottle off.
Exactly. I mean, America is now completely dependent. I mean, China has worked at this and has identified the weak spots, and has has changed and arranged things, and it's taking a tough line. There was an example you probably saw at Nexperia, was a chip manufacturer in Holland, and it was owned by the Chinese. And the Chinese are not the high-tech chips. I'm talking about chips that go into, you know, things like cars and, you know, fridges and so on, whatever. And it was a Chinese company. It was run by a Chinese person. And then under strong pressure from Washington, they said that they had to change the ownership. And then they seized the company. They just seized it. Nexperia, they seized the company. And said, well, we're not going to have, this is dual use, this is a security issue. And China said, okay, no chips coming to Europe. And then suddenly Europeans were faced with the fact that their car industry was screaming, and their various other industries saying, you know, I mean, we can't live without these chips. So China has done this very, you know, CAF thought this through very, very carefully. And so, you know, the question is how long it will last, I think. the deal that there is, you know, on the one hand, raw earth, and on the other hand, a relaxation of American export controls on tech in components and inputs that, and chips going to China. How long will it last? Well, this the Chinese don't know, which is why they're playing the game quite carefully, because they know, and Xi has come very clearly to the understanding that, you know, Trump is capricious. One day he says one thing, one day it'll be another. Will there be tariffs or will there be something else? I mean, he's gone around the Southeast Asia threatening everyone with huge tariffs and then saying, okay, well, you give us, you know, $500 billion in investments in America and we'll reduce the tariffs. I mean, it is a sort of protection racket going around. So China's very wary of this. So, you know, what it can do, even before the meeting began, China said, well, we'll buy, and they bought three shiploads of soybeans to sort of make it a good start to the discussion. I mean, they were buying a lot of American soy, and then it stopped, went to absolute zero in this recent sort of trade war. And they switched to buying Brazilian. And the price differential is tiny, 1-2%, something like that, very small. So they'll, I think, buy a little bit of American soy, but then we'll see what happens. But they won't abandon Brazil altogether.
That's going to be my question: what about Brazil in this? Did they just leave them high and dry, or are they just reducing?
No, they'll just buy, you know, a little bit, I think, from America, but they won't buy. They won't cut Brazil off. Brazil is part of the BRICS,
right?
Wouldn't do that.
And before we get to the chip issue, the rare earths, I wonder if you could, I guess, give us your best assessment of how China will play the medium term, maybe even the long term game, because the United States has recognized the bottleneck here in the Western world at large. And the United States is starting to now invest significantly in rare earths production and then in the refinement as well. But best guess I've seen is that if they put in a really aggressive approach, it might be a decade before they're doing anything of any sizable percentages that can lift it. So China is probably, I mean, for right now, this is going to work in them because they still have 93%. But as time goes on and that changes, how would that affect the Chinese ability or their actions regarding the rare earths?
Well, of course, the Chinese leverage would, over the years, come down with the purchase. But as I say, you know, I mean, some of these places, I mean, I think it's very unlikely. Japan was asked to provide rare earths to the United States, I think, in this round, just before these negotiations took place. And it said it would provide some part of it. But 60% of its rare earths come from China anyway. So, I mean, it's having to give back some of the Chinese ones. But as I say, one of the restrictions that was imposed in this latest rounds when they, if you look, put the export controls on rare earths, China also put the export controls on the machinery by which to mine rare earths. And it's very sophisticated machinery, and they have pretty well domination of that market. They also put export controls on the machinery for cutting chips. They have now new elements and their machinery that, if you like, machine tools that cut chips. That's rather a low-level description of something that's highly sophisticated, not just a simple machine tool, of course. But they have, again, dominance in this field. So, I mean, a lot of what we've been hearing is propaganda. I mean, it's understandable. Trump wants to make this sound very favorable, so it is propaganda. But the reality is China has leverage over the United States in this position. However Trump wants to portray it, they have the leverage. Now, the question is, can one move to some sort of new type of relationship? Well, one of the things that was very interesting, I'm sure you saw it and probably discussed it in your program, was that the RAND organization, which is very closely associated with the military-industrial complex, a very reputable NGO in Washington, came out recently with a report basically upending American foreign policy. They came out and they said, look, it's best if we learn to live with China, that we cannot defeat China, and that we need to be able to recognize and acknowledge the legitimacy of China and its government, and even went as far as saying, and also we should encourage the Taiwanese to stop their provocations against China by talking all the time about independence, and we should recognize the One China policy practically as well. So there was this very important report from China, which, I mean, was saying, you know, we just have to be realistic. There's no way that America can take on China militarily as it is. It's not feasible. Why can we not come to an understanding by which we recognize the legitimacy of China and stop provoking them? Now, the question, of course, is, you know, whether anything will change, whether this is possible. I mean, RAND is, you know, a serious organization with weight in Washington. But is this going to change foreign policy? And who will change it? And how? Who can lead a foreign cultural change? Because really, this is ending the whole of the post-war era. You know better than I. Of, you know, well, we won the Cold War, and, you know, culturally, militarily, and economically, we won it completely, and so we have the right to be have a special position in the world, and as Trump put it, you know, run the world, run this country, and run the world, as he put it. Well, that, you know, I mean, what RAND is saying is, you know, it doesn't work anymore. We have to sort of move on from this, which is quite a significant thing to say. But what is not clear is a RAND report enough to change something as so deeply embedded as the idea that the Wolfowitz doctrine, which was that America cannot allow a rival, economic or military rival, to emerge that threatens U.S. primacy. That was the Wolfowitz one doctrine, yeah, which was embodied in the national security understanding. Yeah,
there's definitely going to be a lot of headwinds against that in Washington, even though I'm adamantly in support of that recognition of reality. Whether we want to or not, it is going to be the reality, and we can either profit from it or exacerbate a bad situation. I guess we'll see how it's going to play out.
And the second thing that comes from this is, you know, RAND says this, and the report is about, you know, managing the ascendancy of China, which is a valid thing. But it says nothing because, you know, the unanswered question, the unposed question is, if it's possible to come to terms like that with China, recognize its legitimacy and the legitimacy of of its interests, why can't we do that with Russia? Why can't we do the same with Iran? Why, if you are going to live as best you can and say, you know, we will come to terms with it as best we can, why not then, if you like, Iran and Russia? Well, the answer is a complex one, I suspect. You know better than I, because it goes to really something that people don't want to address. Who is it who runs who defines American foreign policy? And that is, you know, there are different elements within that structure. And so, whereas it's possible to say these things, perhaps, to say these things about China, those that are dominating American foreign policy, mostly, if you like, pro-Israeli donors that are big supporters of Trump, are not likely to take this view that the Rand takes, that it's possible to come, you know, just accept reality and then come to terms with it, because, you know, Israel entirely depends on United States military hegemony in the world, and particularly in the Middle East. So this is the question then, you know, that comes up. So why has he got, might he be able to do a deal with China, but can't do a deal with Russia? Well, because I think in the one hand, he can do a deal with China because there are factions within that sort of donor cadre that sits at the top of the political structure in America. And some of them are Wall Street, and some of them are straightforward pro-Israeli donors and supporters. I mean, I was really surprised how specific and how explicit President Trump was when he gave that speech at the Knesset, which said, you know, these donors come in and they tell me who to appoint, and I do that. But yeah, here we have
a squishy moment.
But there are the other ones, which are the ones on Wall Street. And yes, they are also pro-Zionist, but actually their main concern is the U.S. economy. And their main concern is the fragility of the U.S. economy and the sense that they have this great bubble blown in the markets. But they have something else which is more concerning, is that now there's been a huge expansion of credit, I mean, and liquidity and credit throughout the American economy, from the banks, but from Wall Street, financialized, you know, everyone is giving credit. In fact, 50% of American credit is now not granted by banks that are regulated, that are part of the institution structures and who are, you know, properly regulated, but comes from the shadow banking system. And I heard one of the chief economists of the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, and he said in Geneva, and he said, listen, we have no idea what is going on in the shadow banking system. None. And so this is what you're seeing. There are credit worries and fractures in that. There have been two, if you like, credit events taking place in the shadow system now in America. So they're very anxious, and that's why a lot of the Federal Reserve suddenly changed the, if you like, the reserve requirements on banks, which allowed something like $2.4 trillion extra credit to go into the system just recently in order to prop up and, I think, plug holes in the private banking system. So, I mean, this all of this is at the center of geopolitics at the moment. It's not just about, you know, Russia, Ukraine, and Iran. It is really about the, you know, that financial system, and also about de-dollarization and America's weakness or vulnerability. And in that, it was quite so fascinating, which will change things enormously, was that when the new Japanese prime minister came in, Tanai Takichai, she said, first of all, she went and talked to her big corporations, Japanese corporations, and went around them just after inauguration. And they said to her very plainly, Prime Minister, we cannot cope with a trade war with America. We cannot exist with one. And she said, well, what do we do? And they said, we have to move into the Chinese sphere. We have far more relations with China now. Our supply lines, our everything is with China, not with America. And if there's a trade war, we will be in a very bad position. And so she advocated and said very clearly, I will not support a trade war against China, Japan. Mm. And she said something which was startling, which was, we do no longer view China as an enemy. For Japan to say that is quite a powerful thing. She also said she planned to work with South Korea and China to establish a common trading and clearing system for trade, a common area, even a common currency, perhaps in due course, with China and South Korea. And South Koreans are also looking positively about that. And so when Trump said to her, I mean, obviously, you know, everyone knows how to deal with Trump. You know, you have a big fanfare and drums and dance right. and things like that. And she had all of that. But when he said, now you've got to stop taking oil from Russia, she said, no, not in our interest to do that. So things are changing in the sort of geopolitical setup.
Yeah, it's something that is long overdue. Let me ask you a question, because one of the complaints and fears among many, especially in Washington, is that, well, you have to play tough and you have to play hardball with China, because if you go into this area where you no longer view them as the enemy and you try to have win-win kind of outcomes, they'll just take advantage of it and they'll roll you over, and then they will take the ascendancy over you and it will work to our disadvantage. What do you say to that?
I would say that is a mistake, unless you're really sure that you have the leverage and can follow through with that leverage. Because if this is just bluff and bluster, then the Chinese will see through it. And I think and people have said this, what has changed is that in the first term, Xi was a bit flummoxed by Trump, by his sudden change from, you know, aggression to, if you like, very, very, very charming and very nice, and how he managed things. And so Xi worked on this and decided that the way to deal with Trump in his second term, now this being one of the first meetings, was to be very, very tough and very unpredictable for the Americans, to play back at Trump his own sort of tactics of negotiation, unpredictability and toughness. So they prepared this quite well in advance, as I say. And the point is, they're not bluffing. They have the leverage and can follow through with the leverage. Whereas generally, this, you know, tough talk that has been coming from Washington towards China, a lot of it is bluff, and a lot of it is a sort of attempt to build confidence amongst Americans and amongst the markets that really AI and the tech world is going to be, you know, the new cornucopia for America. It's going to produce, you know, all the licensing fees. America is going to dominate in this field. But the only problem with this, and the Chinese have seen it and understand it very clearly, the only problem with this is, you've seen these data centers springing up. You've built 5,400, I believe, big, massive data centers churning out, managing data and information. But you don't see anyone in them. You know, they don't employ people. They are just huge data centers. But of course, the GDP in America looks as if it's growing, because, you know, NVIDIA spends another $200 billion on another data center. And so the whole thing has become a really strategic big bet on this happening, and that America can dominate in the data management. And increasingly, the banks and others are beginning to say, hold on, you know, actually, you know, AI isn't being as useful as people thought it was. it isn't being profitable. And actually, the revenues are running at about, at the most, will be at running at about 3% of the capital investment concern. I mean, that's not going to spin into a sort of successor to the petrodollar structure for America. So, so there's a great deal of concern. And that's why I think that the, you know, the Wall Street donors for Trump, who also would like, would approve, if you like, of the sending a no to Mr. Trump about coming to a deal on Ukraine with Russia, to normalize with Russia. Because these were the people, I mean, who historically have always, you know, yearned after Russian resources, would really like to see the narrative that you hear that Russia economy is actually disintegrating and getting lower and lower and lower, in the hope, you know, that they could return to the Yeltsin years, to the 90s, when, you know, you could buy up large pubs. Don't forget, I mean, these were the people. I mean, I don't say all of them, and I use my words carefully of this, but historically, these, some of these banks were the banks that, you know, financed the Bolshevik Revolution in the first place. And of course, Putin knows that and understands that. So in a sense, there's a sort of contiguity between the, you know, the hardline pro-Israeli donors that we all know, the Adelsons and all those others around them, Larry Ellisons and so on. Then these ones, the Wall Street faction, which is slightly different, different branch of Islam, not particularly Zionists, although they do see Israel essentially as a tool of power. They know that, you know, what power they have in the United States comes, if anything, from their control of Israel, from being, you know, the masters on the Israeli subject, because that provides them the congressional control and the control in many of the sort of institutions of the United States. So this is the sort of double thing. So, yes, Trump, you can do a deal. You can do a deal with Beijing, but, you know, let's see how much you've had to give to Z to get the deal. And, but secondly, with a deal normalization with Russia, no, you're not going to be allowed to do that. The quite clearly the message was, you saw the way it was canceled and everything, you saw the message was very clear. That is not going to be allowed.
Right. And in fact, that's in the remainder of the time we have with you here today, I want to touch on an issue you briefly mentioned a minute ago and really directly related to what you just said here. And that is the nexus between whatever's going on with this deal with China and all the different relations and the situation in Russia, as insofar as this oil issue goes. So President Trump, just a week or so ago, leveraged this huge new sanctions on two Russian oil giants to say, hey, anybody who does business with them is going to have these big sanctions and tariffs put on them, et cetera. The primary targets were China and India. And I think I saw one comment from Trump here that said, yeah, we didn't really talk about that. So another one of the things, it's odd how that wasn't even on the agenda after this great meeting. But how do you see this? And both with China and with India, their willingness to actually concede to what Trump wants to do, to not buy Russian oil. How is that going to play out?
Oh, China has already made it absolutely clear they will have. They said to America the following. They said, listen, our relations between China and Russia and with Iran are none of your business, full stop. That's what they said. Keep out of it. It's none of your business, and we will not accept it, and we will continue trading. And of course, with China doing that, India will do it. The only difference with India is that much more of their oil and gas is pipeline supplied. is ship supplied. And so we'll see, you know, a change in the shadow fleet. I mean, there's no such thing as a shadow fleet. It's just, you know, tankers go and they have a different flag one day and they change it to another flag. They fly under a different authority and then they transship at sea. And so, you know, there'll be a small sort of pause. And then I think you'll see Russia selling as much oil. And anyway, it may be a tiny bit less, but the price will be higher because of these sanctions have pushed the price up. So I know that Russia is not particularly, just to be clear, what's really important here is, I mean, those sanctions, you know, they're not nothing, but they're not grave, and they're not, you know, in any way sort of strategically going to change the economy in a strategic way at all. But what was the red line? There were two things. One was at Anchorage. The Russians understood from Trump that he would keep sanctions away from Russia to allow it to pursue a political solution. And secondly, that and that red line has been broken with these sanctions. It's not so much an economic matter. Why Russia takes it so seriously is it is a political red line that has been broken. And the second political red line was the one which was there would be no frozen conflict on the site as it is now. This is going to be a frozen conflict, which most Russians understand is a trap. That they have to avoid. And they've been in this before, Minsk, and even going back to 1918 and that treaty there where they lost Ukraine and parts of Poland and elsewhere. Everyone understands. And when I was in St. Petersburg just a couple of months ago, 2-3 months, St. Petersburg is the liberal capital of Russia. I mean, you know, always connected to the West. It's, you know, there's a station, a Finnish station, Finland station is right in St. Petersburg. And there, you know, people said very clearly, listen, we've invested blood to get to this point. And we are not about to see another Minsk Accord, a deceit imposed on us so that the West can rearm and regroup in Ukraine, and that then we will have to spill more blood in 3 or 4 years' time. We just not going to accept that. Putin may not do a deal like that. It's unacceptable. We've spent enough on it. We want the thing to be completed. We want it to be done with. So, I mean, it's not a question of political affiliation or being pro-Putin or anti-Putin. This is how people feel about, you know, the threat to their children.
So let me ask you a question, because the most likely, I guess, solution for that is, which Putin has said himself here recently in Beijing, most recently, they'll just accomplish it on the battlefield. They'll take what they want by force of arms to accomplish their security needs as they see them. Or he reiterated there, they will take it at the diplomatic table. What can, as best as you can ascertain, what would a diplomatic solution look like right now that's acceptable to Russia? And let's just look at it from that perspective right now. Is there a deal that Russia would actually accept on the negotiating table to bring this to an end?
Oh, yes. I mean, and we saw it. It was the deal which was largely inked and initialed by the Ukrainian side in Istanbul in 22. And it included the issue of neutrality and no NATO, and it included questions of troop levels and foreign troops being involved with it, and it included, if you like, guarantees that Russia and other states would give to Ukraine. And then Boris Johnson was sent by the collective security structures and said, no way, you can't normalize with Russia.
But the two issues that were the most contentious, I think, there's a lot of them, but two that may be the most hardest for the Ukraine, if not impossible, the demilitarization and the denazification. So instead of getting security guarantees from the West, they're going to get a rump military lift over, like a Weimar or a, yeah, Weimar Republic type, 100,000 troops that are, and then what would a denazification look like? That may be the biggest one of all, because that would imply some sort of political change inside of Ukraine, willingly.
Well, of course, but, you know, it is inevitable because, you know, really starting back in 48, 49, the British, actually started preparing. It had its old stay behind forces. That were infiltrating Russia, and they were then turned to be stay-behind forces against the Soviet Union. And those were linked with the Ukraine. Many of them were Ukrainians. I mean, that is Western Ukrainian. And so at the time of the Maidan, both CIA and MI6 carefully put in people into the police, into the military, the intelligence, and the political echelons who would be fiercely and could be counted on to be totally anti-Russian, Russophobes, and would stay with the extreme, if you like, nationalist position that you cannot deal with Russia and you cannot make an accord with Russia. So we, the West, and Britain and America, put those people in precisely to prevent an accord being signed between the two. So when it came to it, as I say, in Istanbul in 22, and when the Ukrainians have signed most of those papers, or at least initialed. It was never agreed, of course, but it was signed off by them. The answer is no. And one of the reasons is because that cadre that was installed after Maidan and sort of selected from people that had a past were never going to, will never agree to this, will never back down. And that's why Russia keeps going on about denazification, is saying that, the hatred of those people for Russia is so intense. And has, got a history going back so far, not Maidan, but right back into the Second World War period.
Yeah.
You can't come to an agreement. And in a sense, if you can't talk to the other side, if it's not possible and they won't talk to you. And I've always said that. I've been involved in many sort of negotiations, ceasefires and things like that. The first thing is you've got to get to the point that Rand was making, interestingly enough, is that you have to recognize, you can say, look, I don't agree with this man, my opponent. I don't agree with him. I don't agree with his history is completely wrong. And his vision for the future, I can't accept that either. But I now accept that this person has a legitimate point of view. And is a representative of his people or her people. Once you say that, then politics is possible. But if those people will not talk and will not have anything to do with Russian, and we only have to look at the history of them trying, having to suppress the Russian language, suppress, everything Russian during that period, the chances of being able to sit down and have a serious talk, as soon as they learn of it, it'll be stopped. So that's what he means by denazification. It's not, it's not to try and sort of put a political character a category and say, anyone who's on the right is not allowed. It's not that sort of, European style, cordon sanitaire. It is simply saying, there have to be people, Ukrainians, military, whatever, but who are able to talk and able to come to terms.
So given the history that you just talked about, let's run from MI6, CIA, going all the way back to 47, 40, 48, et cetera, that seeds that were planted then, if we're just being honest, is there even a rational possibility to get to a negotiated denazification that's acceptable to Russia, or literally have we baked in that Russia can only have a military victory here and be satisfied?
I see no basis, as things stand, I see no basis for a negotiated settlement involving United States and Russia about Ukraine. I see no basis for it at all. I think we're deceiving ourselves if we think it's possible. If there's a change in the circumstances, if something happens in this next period in the sort of Donbass and other areas, who knows? But at the moment, I see no prospect of it. And so, and also, given the sense that, you know, the mood in the team of Trump is now solidly against any negotiation with, not solidly, there's Witkoff, of course, but I mean solidly against any sort of real negotiation with it. They've turned, you know, there's been a big shift. You know, not so long ago, most of the West was saying, oh, well, you know, Ukraine can win and Ukraine is going to succeed and thing. Now we've gone to the other side, is how to define failure, how to define failure as victory. I mean, you know, yes, now we can try and pretend it's victory because, you know, oh, Russia, you know, actually it's eating up their economy, this war, it's eating it up. They're getting weaker and weaker and, you know, with time. So that it is a sort of holding exercise, a victory, not this year, next year, but 3 years' time. And the Europeans sort of lap this up and say, yes, you know, we just got to put enough money aside. And then 3 years' time or something like that, Russia will be so weakened. I mean, it's nonsense, complete nonsense. It's a fabrication. It's just psyops, that's all.
Yeah. Well, that's where we are right now. And I guess we're going to have to wait and see, as you say, what could happen in the Donbass and then in both Kupiansk and in Pokrovsk, which could change the dynamic on the battlefield. We'll have to see how that plays out here in the coming period of time. But we are incredibly grateful for having you come on today, especially in talking about a lot of these issues here. And we would definitely like to send folks back to your Conflicts Forum, a geopolitical oracle, and on your Substack forum, because lots of great, great stuff there. That's one of the reasons we were glad to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you very much. It was, of course, as I said, at the outset, a pleasure to join you.
I look forward to having you back real soon. And we thank you guys for being with us today. And also let you know, actually less than 30 minutes from now, we've got another great international relations theorist here on this side of the pond. John Mearsheimer is going to be talking about this new nuclear arms race and just what in the hell is going on with that. That's I said 30 minutes. That's actually at 1 o'clock today. So about an hour and a half from now, we'll look forward to seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.